Science Friday is supported by Progressive. Now, most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Just a quick note before we get started. We miss you. We miss talking to you. And we want you to say hello. So please talk to us on the Science Friday Vox Pop app, on Twitter, or even email us, scifry@sciencefriday.com. Later in the hour, we explore new insights into the genetic story of the early humans who populated East Asia. But first, in the bird world, you can be one of two branches of the evolutionary tree. Either you're one of the 10,000 flying songbirds, shorebirds, and raptors, or you're one of just 70 species in the group of mostly flightless birds, like ostriches, emus, and the fierce giant cassowary, a native of Australia, New Guinea, and nearby islands. Cassowaries, with their strong legs and vicious toes, have a well-earned reputation as aggressive, dangerous birds, more than just a scary face. Producer Christy Taylor takes a closer look at new research on the evolutionary mysteries of cassowaries and their close relations. And she begins, of course, with their feathers.
If you've ever looked at a cassowary, I hope you'll agree that they're not just weird-looking, flightless murderers. They're also kind of gorgeous. They've got these bald, bright blue necks and really glossy, fluffy-looking black feathers that drape their very powerful bodies. It's that black glossiness that caught the eye of Dr. Julia Clark, a paleontologist at the University of Texas in Austin. She joins me to explain how a close look at feather color can help scientists understand not just the evolution of cassowaries, but also their extinct cousins and the dinosaurs that gave rise to them. Welcome back to Science Friday, Dr. Clark.
It's my pleasure to join you, Christy.
Julia, when I look at a cassowary, my first question is really not, why is it so shiny?
Well, yeah, I guess that isn't most people's first question about cassowaries. Maybe their first question is it going to kill me? Shininess is not unusual in many, many groups of birds, but in the group of birds to which cassowaries belong, it is. So that's kind of what got us started on this. And I happened to be in a collection space in the Netherlands, and they had some cassowary specimens, and it was so striking. And these were even kind of a little bit dusty, you know? And I was struck by how shiny these feathers were, and I was like, how?
Okay, so this feels like a question I would ask in a fable, but how did the cassowary get so shiny? You set out to investigate. What did you find out?
Well, we at first thought there might be modifications of the structure on the outside most part of the feather so that the feather keratin could be particularly smooth and maybe more reflective. So we investigated that, and it didn't seem to be, you know, explanatory. It didn't seem to explain the phenomenon. And then my co-author, who did the sort of biophysics of this structure, found that it was actually some aspects of the dimensions of the rachis, or the center part of the feather itself, that was contributing to the shine. And to be clear, what we found was that cassowary shiny blackness is among the brightest known shiny blackness in living birds. So this wasn't just a moderate thing, but this is up in the zone of a shiny crow feathers, for example. But that shine in cassowaries is produced by having really fat, wide center parts of the feathers. It's actually aspects of the feather geometry that are most important to determining that shine.
Is being shiny a useful adaptation for either a bird or a dinosaur? Like, if you look at a cassowary, I feel like it has everything it needs just in those really powerful feet.
Man, cassowaries are so fascinating. And if we think about what colors do more broadly is that they can be used in crypsis or camouflage, or they can be used in communication, and typically communication with other members of their own species. But it also could be, since cassowaries live in these typically heavily forested environments, and we can't rule out the possibility that these black feathers could function in crypsis. It could function in somehow making the cassowary blend better into a shadow-doppled forest environment. But I will say that most shiny feathers in birds that have been studied are related to communication. So they function in what we call the sexual selection system, which might be in things related to finding a mate.
Because I feel like I don't have this picture in my head quite yet. If we're looking at a feather, the part that the cassowary has that's shiny is like the trunk of a tree, right?
Exactly.
So how is a crow's feather, a black shiny crow feather, where is that shine coming from if it's not like this tree trunk part of the feather?
So if a feather is tree-like and it has a central trunk, that's the rachis, then off of that come barbs. And then off those barbs come the twiglets, which are the barbules. And in the crows and in many other birds, the shiny black color is conferred by changes in the structure of those twiglets. So in birds like a shiny pheasant or a shiny iridescent peacock, for example, you're going to have shine conferred by the arrangement of these melanin pigment filled structures within the feathers themselves. And there could be one layer of these or multiple layers. And the spacing of the layers could even determine whether they refract more of a reddish tone, shiny black, or more of a blue-green tone, shiny black. So that's basically the mechanism that we've now found evidence for in non-avian dinosaurs that have branched feathers.
I'm really glad you mentioned dinosaurs because I know you're a paleontologist and I really want to know why you're looking at living modern birds and their color right now.
So I think sometimes kind of moving between being motivated by questions about things we see in deep time can bring us to ask new questions of animals in the present day. And conversely, we go the other direction. Maybe we understand a mechanism. Now that we understand this mechanism of shine in the cassowary, we could bring that understanding to look back at the fossil record and say, could we find evidence of this form of shininess in the fossil record? What would those fossils look like? How would we maybe ask that question? So right now we have a dinosaur that's about 120 million years that shows that those long, skinny, melanin-containing structures that make shiny blacks in things like crows or things like chickens and ducks. But we also have evidence from about 140 million years of another form of structural color. So that would have been potentially some shiny component. But what was really cool is that in dinosaurs that are even more distantly related to birds, we call these, you know, among friends, fuzzy dinosaurs. These are things, yeah, it was, you know.
Adorable.
It's clear that they're not hair covered, but what they have are thin filaments, maybe several filaments connected together at the base. Then maybe they have thicker filaments that would be with something we'd call a bristle. And those vary in different species of fuzzy dinosaurs, these dinosaurs that are more distantly related to birds. But we haven't found any evidence of these melanin pigment-based mechanisms for making shine in those filamentous structures. And so what's interesting about the cassowary, I think, is this is a mechanism of coloration that does not depend upon the shape of those pigment-containing organelles. That's really conferred by the shape of the bristle itself. And this might be a mechanism by which fuzzy dinosaurs got shiny. But now we can turn to the fossil record and maybe think, how might this be preserved? Maybe their feathers in amber, for example. Maybe there are other, you know, just exceptional cases. Because it really depends on what fossil records you look at, what kind of information you can get from them.
I gotta say, when I look at a cassowary, when I look at an ostrich, when I look at an emu, I feel like I'm looking at something that is a lot more closely related to non-avian dinosaurs than like a pigeon. You know, do we see that they're more primitive?
So I think what we see when we look at them and are like, oh my gosh, big dinosaurs, is that we can recognize their affinities with these flightless, like all of the bipedal raptors and other dinosaurs that we more commonly encounter in the media, in museums. We can make that relationship more easily because they're big. They're bigger than other things. So what we know happens in the evolution of our living birds today is that they generally got smaller and they evolved flight. And then in these living guys like cassowaries and ostrich, they reverse that trend. So they lose flight and they get big. So it's not an ancestral bigness, but it does harken back. It helps us make that connection with non-avian dinosaurs.
So is there any living bird that you would say probably has the most to tell us about how these birds arose from non-avian dinosaurs?
Oh, man, I love them all, you know? I mean, you can't pick just one species as... People used to do this, and actually the most notable case was Scott's polar expedition, right? The thinking at the time was that penguins were one of the groups that were going to shed the most light on the origin of birds because their feathers are highly, well, now we know, modified and quote unquote scale-like. Mm-hmm. And people thought that was a primitive trait. And they thought that if you could observe the ontogeny from the egg of a penguin, like an emperor penguin, you might know about the origin of birds. Well, all of those things are completely false. You would learn a lot about the development of penguins, which independently lost flight, but you wouldn't learn about bird origin. So there's no one species that's going to show you differentially more about that origin. But I will say that when you look at songbirds outside our windows, those are among the most heavily modified of living birds. They have a lot of new traits that are absent in most other birds. Mm-hmm. And when we look at things like a chicken or a duck, those species have been, you know, parts of groups that have been evolving independently for, I want to say, you know, more than 65 million years. So they have had their own separate history. Each one of those is, let's say, you know, if it's alive today, it's equidistant from the bird ancestor. So we got to look at them together to get that picture of what are traits that that ancestral bird might have that we could bring down and look at in non-avian dinosaurs. We can't just single one out.
Good luck to you in finding that. Thank you so much for joining me today. Julia Clark is a professor of paleontology at the University of Texas at Austin. Thank you again so much.
Thank you, Christy. That was a lot of fun.
When we come back, we'll take a look at one of the lesser understood effects of COVID-19, mysterious blood clots.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here? And maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. The COVID-19 epidemic has become known as a respiratory disease targeting the lungs of infected people. But doctors are also seeing strange responses to the virus in other parts of the body, including the blood. Doctors around the world are reporting unusual blood clotting in a large proportion of hospitalized coronavirus patients. Joining me now to talk about what they are seeing and how medical workers are responding to the clots are two hematologists, Dr. Jeffrey Lawrence, professor of medicine in the Division of Hematology Oncology at Weill Cornell Medicine and attending physician at New York Presbyterian Hospital, and Dr. Mary Cushman, a hematologist at the University of Vermont Medical Center, professor of medicine and pathology at the Lerner College of Medicine at UVM in Burlington, Vermont. Welcome, both of you, to Science Friday.
Thank you.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Nice to have you. Let me begin with you, Dr. Lawrence. Early on, you noticed some unusual clotting in patients with the coronavirus. Please tell us about that.
One of the very first patients that I saw was a young man, and this was early in March, who had symptoms for about 10 days and then got very sick and came into the hospital and was put on a ventilator. And about 3 days into his hospitalization, one of the nurses noted that he had some very strange rashes on his bottom and called a dermatologist who did a biopsy. And they found out that it was a very unusual kind of lesion, one that they typically don't see, that had small blood vessels clotting. And there were so many clots and so many small vessels that on his backside, you could basically see the imprint of what a small microvascular cells would look like right under the skin. And when they sent it to pathology, the pathologist recognized that it was something, some unusual kind of clotting that I had studied in some very unusual cases of rare disorders, and wondered what was that doing in a patient with COVID, particularly a young man. And so we evaluated it for certain proteins that are associated with inflammation and associated with the immune system, complement, and found out that they were deposited there. And thought that was just very, very strange, because it's not something that we're used to seeing in the intensive care unit setting, certainly not something we're used to seeing with other viruses. That was like in an afternoon, say on a Wednesday, and later that night I get a phone call from the autopsy room saying that they have a patient who'd come in and just died and had some unusual lesions on his skin. And they biopsied them and called me about them. And so basically we said, we have a pattern here. And in fact, over the next week, we found three more identical cases. And this was a clue to something funny was happening. And that kind of led us to start investigating what was happening to the clotting system and what was happening to the immune system in these patients, and could they be intimately linked.
How common is this? I know that we hear other cases in other hospitals. Is this something doctors are watching out for?
The vast, vast majority of people that get infected with the coronavirus, that get COVID-19, either don't have symptoms or very mild, don't have to worry about this. But in the severe cases, the ones that filled up our adult emergency room and then filled up our pediatric emergency room with adults are unusual because of the level of clotting. So that typically when a patient comes into the intensive care unit, they're often put on prophylactic blood thinners to prevent them from getting clots, because they're going to be basically lying isolated in an intensive care unit. They may have an infection that will cause their blood to clot a bit more. So they're given prophylactic anti-clotting medicines. But we were seeing clotting on the prophylactic anti-clotting medicines. So we increased the doses in some of these patients, and some of them were still clotting. And then we put them on full doses of anti-clotting medications like heparin that certainly ought to take care of the problem, and we were seeing clotting anyway. In fact, one of the things that made me so cognizant of the problems that we were seeing at our hospital that was not specific to our hospital was when a kidney doctor was quoted on the front page of the New York Times saying that, you know, we've gotten this disease all wrong. We're not going to run out of ventilators. We're going to run out of dialysis machines because we're clotting off the filters and our dialysis machines. And these are patients who are on full doses of anticoagulation. And then I knew we had a real issue, and this is something different than the kind of standard clotting that we were seeing.
Dr. Cushman, what would be causing this kind of clotting in these patients?
The first sort of piece of news that I noticed in the medical literature was a paper out of Wuhan, China, that suggested patients have high levels of biomarkers of clotting, namely a biomarker called D-dimer, which is a marker of the generalized level of proclotability, if you will, within a person. And this is accompanied by high levels of inflammatory biomarkers as well. So there's really kind of three key points that come out of this, that it seems that in some patients who have more severe disease requiring hospitalization, we have this thromboinflammatory process that is triggered, and we don't fully understand the reason for the triggering of it. Some people believe that it's because the virus is affecting and disrupting the inner lining of blood vessels in small and large blood vessels, and disrupting that protective barrier that lines the inner lining of the blood vessels, and that releases substances that can allow the clotting system to be triggered. And this process is really fascinating because it's not been seen with the same pattern of these biomarker changes that we can measure in the lab. This has not been seen in other viral infections or bacterial infections. It's very different than what we're used to seeing. And so the second big finding that I noticed in the literature was that patients in the hospital who have this high level of D-dimer tend to have worse outcomes. They have a higher mortality compared to other patients and a higher likelihood of requiring a transfer to the ICU and a respiratory failure. And so it raises the possibility, as Dr. Lawrence alluded to, that thinning the blood to try to dampen down the pro-clotting effects could be beneficial to patients. And so the third point that came out pretty early in the literature out of China was that patients who had higher levels of D-dimer, representing this thromboinflammatory drive, seemed to benefit the most from these low doses of anticoagulation, of prophylaxis, if you will, that Dr. Lawrence referred to. And so it really raises the question of how we can preserve the outcomes of patients with biomarker-based strategies that might provide, you know, escalated doses of blood thinners in people who even don't have evidence of clots at the time.
Very interesting and mysterious, Dr. Lawrence. Are you seeing any pattern to who develops these clots? Any pattern with regard to age or blood type, race, anything that might predict who's going to be throwing off these clots?
Sure. So as Dr. Cushman said, you know, we all think that rising D-dimers is a bad thing, but how high they should rise and what the trajectory of that rise is needs a controlled clinical trial. But we have kind of clinical points that can help you judge who might be more at risk for rising D-dimers and more clotting. One of them is obesity. So obesity, patients with diabetes, patients with hypertension tend to have faster rises in D-dimers. And women, apparently, women are much less prone to a severe outcome and have less serious diseases for the same ICU admission than men. And that's curious. So what's protecting, you know, women to some extent, and what is harming people of older age, people with obesity, people with diabetes, and people with hypertension? And in fact, the protective factor from women occurs at all ages. So there's one very large study, over 16,000 patients being conducted in hospitals in the United Kingdom, which showed that this protection of female sex occurred at every age range they looked, from 50 to over 90 years of age. And one of the characteristics that appears to protect women and may be harmful in terms of the setting of diabetes, obesity, and hypertension is that patients with pre-existing diabetes, obesity, and hypertension have higher levels of this immune protein substances called complement. They have higher levels at baseline without the COVID of these inflammatory components that Dr. Cushman was talking about, and they have higher levels of D-dimers. So they're kind of at a set point, if you're a male, older age, obesity, diabetes, hypertension, to getting these occurrences. Another thing that's peculiar, and it's come out of a large study from New York City of 5,700 patients, New York City and its surroundings, and the 16,000 United Kingdom study, is that why is it that people with HIV, for their numbers, tend to be getting less severe disease? And why is it with patients with cancer? If you make a list of the 10 risk factors for getting disease, cancer is at the very lowest risk factor. It was barely statistically significant with a relative risk of 1.1. So what's so special about cancer patients and what's so special about HIV? You know, what our hospital would like to say is we just take great care of cancer patients and we're very good at social distancing. We use television and so forth. But I think it's something more than that. And I think it's telling us something about what's bad at having high levels of pre-existing complement and what's good about having some level of immune suppression. Perhaps that's what's driving cancer as less of a risk factor. Perhaps that's what's driving patients with HIV, even when they're on their HIV medicines, because they still have defects in their immune system. And particularly, they have defects in the immune system involving their innate immune system, which complement is part of. So long-winded explanation to say that we don't know what the driving force is, as Dr. Cushman said, to set all this clotting stuff off. We know that there are three pathways that are involved. There's the clotting pathway, there's the inflammation pathway, and there's a complement pathway. And all of them can turn on each other. So you have this insidious positive feedback loop between clotting and the immune system with inflammation and the immune system with complement. And if you can't shut it off, and you may need to intervene at more than one pathway, then you're in a lot of trouble. And in terms of, is it the virus that sets it off at the very first? And what's so special about COVID? Well, one of the things that we and others have shown in early papers is that the virus itself has a protein on its surface, little spikes, if you've seen pictures in the newspapers, which can directly bind to a complement component, can start causing platelets to aggregate, can start initiating clotting factors. So the virus itself may set this off, and if you can't control it for whatever reason, you're kind of stuck in this insidious loop. And so that's why clinical trials are so important, why we need to try multiple interventions, not just antivirus drugs, not just blood thinning drugs, but also anti-complement drugs and anti-inflammation drugs.
What do people need to know about the clotting? They tell us when you're a certain age, you should take a little mini aspirin to prevent the clotting, possibly preventing strokes. Anything like that to be doing here?
Yeah, I would say for this disease, the type of clotting that's going to be most common, apart from the clotting that seems to be tightly linked to the disease itself, like these micro clots that might form in the lungs or kidneys or on the skin, the most common type of abnormal clotting that's going to occur in patients with this infection is deep vein thrombosis and pulmonary embolism. We also call that venous thrombosis. And these are clots in the larger veins of the legs that are returning blood back to the heart. And the danger of those clots is that pieces can break off and travel to the lungs, which is pulmonary embolism. And that's a life-threatening type of abnormal clot. This is the third leading vascular disease after heart attack and stroke. So it's very important, but the public awareness is pretty low on it. So only about 50% of people even know what it is. And any infection, any acute infection, or any hospitalization can raise the risk of venous thrombosis. And COVID seems to be more strongly triggering of these venous thrombosis events. The jury is a little bit out in terms of what the exact incidence is, but it's felt that it's higher. So prevention is really important. So the average person should just be aware of this. And, we don't yet know if this is also affecting people who are sick at home with COVID. Most people with this infection don't get hospitalized. And so if you're sick at home with it, for example, being aware that venous thrombosis could occur is important. And that means knowing the symptoms, which are leg pain and swelling, sometimes discoloration of the legs, chest pain and shortness of breath. And also being sure that if you have symptoms like this, that you don't ignore it and that you seek medical care. We're finding that a lot of people are afraid to come to hospitals because with acute illnesses, because they're afraid they'll catch the infection in the hospital. But really being aware that this disease exists and being aware that it can cause death at the worst, it's important to recognize. The other risk factors we've talked about, like obesity and older age, are also risk factors for venous thrombosis. So if you have those conditions, you want to be especially cautious about it.
In case you just joined us, I'm Ira Flatow, and you're listening to Science Friday from WNYC Studios. This has been called the novel coronavirus, and it seems like there's still so much we don't know about it, isn't there?
Oh, absolutely. It's almost endless, the questions that could be posed. And I think that in hematology research, the research community is supercharged right now to try to do our part to help answer some of these really critical questions. Getting back to this idea of anticoagulation in hospitalized patients, if we were to just start anticoagulating every patient who comes in the hospital, we would cause a lot of bleeding complications. And we don't know really whether that's the right intervention. Maybe an intervention toward the complement system is better, or an anti-inflammatory approach is better. So we don't really know the answer. Yet we're seeing these kinds of protocols arise in hospitals. And it's good because people are doing what they think is best. But doing what you think is best, best for your patient, isn't always the right thing. And so that's where the role of research comes in, and really trying to, in a supercharged way, proceed to launch, you know, major research efforts to answer this question. So that's kind of what's driving us in our clinical trial to say, okay, let's pause here for a moment and figure out, really get the evidence that we need to understand if this is the best approach or not. You know, trying to solve these questions of racial disparities. Is it all due to socioeconomic factors, or is there a biological difference in the coagulopathy in these patients that is contributing to the worst outcomes? You know, we really don't know. And we can't get these answers without research. So for your listeners who are, you know, science geeky people, you know, this is the scientific process is laid out right here for you to see. And I think it's just a really exciting time for answering new questions. And maybe we'll find out answers to questions that relate to other diseases as well.
We have run out of time. I'd like to thank both of you. Dr. Mary Cushman, hematologist at the University of Vermont Medical Center, professor of medicine and pathology at the Lerner College of Medicine at UVM in Burlington, Vermont. Dr. Jeffrey Lawrence, professor of medicine in the Division of Hematology Oncology at Weill Cornell Medicine and attending physician at New York Presbyterian Hospital. Thank you both for taking time to join us today.
You're very welcome.
You're welcome.
We're going to take a break. And when we come back, tracking through the history of China via genetics. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. The human family tree is complicated, like most families. The roadmap of how our ancient ancestors journeyed out of Africa and across the globe is filled with twists and turns, dead ends, and missing pieces. One of those missing pieces is how early humans populated East Asia. Scientists are using ancient genomes to fill in that story, and producer Alexa Lim has more.
The history of a group of people can be reconstructed through what they've left behind. That can be artifacts like pottery, written text, or even pieces of their own DNA, found in ancient bones and in their living descendants. A group of scientists examined 26 ancient genomes from East Asia that give clues to how people spread through that continent 10,000 years ago. Their results were published this month in the journal Science. Melinda Yang is one of the authors on that study. She's a professor of biology at the University of Richmond in Virginia. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So you looked at the genomes of East Asians who lived during the Neolithic Age, which is around 10,000 years ago. Can you describe that era? Humans were living in communities then. What were they like?
I would say that the Neolithic Age started around 10,000 years ago. That was like the early Neolithic. And then that lasted until about 4,000 to 3,000 years ago when you start transitioning into the Bronze Age. And then so this period is largely defined by the development of farming, and associated with farming, very settled communities that start across this time period changing in complexity. So at the very beginning, 10,000 years ago, there's still a lot of questions about, oh, there's a little bit of evidence of farming, but there's a lot of things that show it's not their major mode of economy. And then by the late Neolithic, you start getting very established, complicated settlements that sometimes show levels of hierarchy. There may be walls that are around these settlements. There may be sort of things that look like prestige items that sort of suggest that there's perhaps some inequalities, you know, amongst the people that live within that community.
So like I mentioned, you collected these samples of ancient genomes. What was the main question you were trying to answer in your study?
So we had populations, well, we had individuals, sorry, from northern China, sort of along the lower edges of the Yellow River, sort of the main river in northern China. And then we had individuals from southern China who were along the southern coast near the Taiwan Strait. So basically with these two, we sort of have samples from the two major regions of China. But because we have these samples, we could start asking, okay, what are the differences between these two groups? There's not really a clear difference between these two groups today, if you look at their genomes of present day populations. And so what was it like at this point in the early Neolithic? Are there changes that we can observe that are tied to this time period? But I think the first thing is we just had no samples from this area, and it's a major archaeological region. There's major transitions that are happening during this time period. So we wanted to be like, what is it that's happening in mainland China?
Right. Whenever we talk about like genetic splits in populations, it gets like complicated keeping track. It's like trying to keep track of all the characters in Game of Thrones, right?
Yeah.
So then what you're saying is, you know, there were these two genetically distinct northern and southern groups. And then they kind of mixed. Is that what happened?
That's one of the first big findings that we saw, is that when we looked at these past populations, perhaps really starting from the early Neolithic, so that's about 9,500 to 8,000 years ago are the samples that we have from then. And then we have it from both sides. And when we looked at them and we compared them to each other, we found that they were much more, they were very genetically distinct from each other in a way that present day populations from those two areas were not. So that was our first big thing of like, oh, here we can find this differentiation from each other that is very hard to discern if you just use modern human genomes from the same regions today. Then after that, like the very fact that we see that difference between back then and today sort of was this marker of like, hey, admixture is likely the big thing, or some intermixing between these populations is likely the big thing that is made it so that today's populations don't have this level of differentiation.
And when you say admixture, that means they're having kids with each other, right?
Yeah. So admixture is a technical term, sorry. So basically when they're having kids with each other, if they're from two very distinct groups of people genetically, then you can sort of see that mixing in the genome, because you get one from your mom, one from your dad in terms of like your chromosomes, each of your chromosomes. And then so therefore, if there's really different patterns, say your mom comes from a population that has mutation A, and then your dad comes from a population that has mutation B, you're going to have a mix of those, right? And then if you're looking at it in a population level, you're looking at sort of like frequencies of these mutations. And if you have ones that show up that you don't typically find, it's more likely that it came from an outside population than that it was a new and separate mutation that happened at the exact same spot. That's really statistically unlikely.
Right. And so then why did the northern population start moving down, or why did it start becoming more dominant?
So here I'm going to say, and it's a bit more speculation, but what we need is I think more samples from these areas. But because of the fact that we see this occurring in like in the early Neolithic, you don't really see this mixing, but then you do see it by the late Neolithic within those southern populations. And then you do see most of that northern ancestry today. The combination of that and previous archaeological studies that have shown that there's this expansion of farming that sort of comes across out from the Yellow River region, which became like a major farming area by the late Neolithic. And so this area, these people were likely moving southward and carrying some of their farming technology with them, right? And so therefore you see a later spread of farming technology in certain areas of the South. And so therefore you sort of have this overall story of a north to south wave that's occurring across many different regions. And then when we're studying this, we're seeing it over and over again in different places. So that's really neat.
So then where did the southern group go?
One of our other major findings here is, big thing here is we don't have samples from more inland southern China. So who knows what, you know, on that other side and like what types of ancestries are there. But at least these people that we do have from coastal mainland China, what we found is that they show a really close relationship to present day Austronesians. And so Austronesian refers to sort of a language family that's found in Taiwan, in islands of Southeast Asia, and islands of the Southwest Pacific. But what's really cool is that these ancient Southern East Asians, they show a really close relationship to these Austronesians. What I mentioned is that the Southern ancestry sort of still exists a little bit in humans today. So they clearly mixed with the Northern populations that were coming down. And so they still persist in mainland China. But then in these peoples also moved into Taiwan and then into, you know, the rest of Southeast Asia and the Pacific Southwest. I guess in a way to say they have like the living remnants. Oh. And then so that's where they still exist sort of in the most clear genetic ancestry of them.
Right. Okay. So I want to take a step even further back. One of the earliest modern human scientists found in East Asia dates back to 40,000 years ago. Who was that person?
Yeah. So that was the Tanyuan man. He is an individual that was found at a really important site for paleoanthropology that's right in Western Beijing, but he's 40,000 years old. And so he's very clearly mostly related to modern humans, very clearly a Homo sapien. The big finding that we had with him was that this is essentially an early Asian. So it's not very closely related to East Asians, but it's closest to them relative to Europeans, for instance. And so we have sort of something that's, you could call Asian-like in terms of their genetics 40,000 years ago in this area. But it's also the ancestor to, you know, all the Southeast Asians. It's also ancestor to Native Americans who, before they crossed the Bering Strait. So you have like a very old Asian ancestry is what I'd call it. There's more recent stuff from other studies that show that there's other ancestries that are also super old and diverged and separate from present day East Asians that we find more recently that are in Southeast Asia. There's something that exists in Japan that's also a fairly old ancestry. And none of these look like present day East Asians today. We know that the Tangerine individual, their ancestry had to have persisted in some form until more recently, because you see in Native Americans, some groups have a little bit more shared affinity to this guy than others do, which suggests that they must have been carrying some Tangerine-like ancestry, some of the groups when they were crossing the Bering Strait. This Tangerine ancestry, a big question I think still remains of like, how long did it last in China or mainland Asia? Who did it contribute? Is there any evidence left of their ancestry up until more recent times? And so a lot of people are interested in that question, especially in my lab in China.
So he's not like a direct ancestor. He's like a cousin.
Yeah. A cousin, a first cousin, third cousin, you know, something like that.
Right.
Or twice removed. Maybe that's the right word.
twice removed. Right. And then you said he's related to the Native American populations.
There was this interesting find in South America that's solely comparing present day humans with each other. What they found was that some groups in South America shared a little bit of a connection to groups in Papua New Guinea, in Australia, and in the Andaman Islands off the coast of India. And so these three groups that they were looking at, they split off really, really early for non-African populations. Mm-hmm. They have this very old ancestry there that if you were to look at them, it sort of dates back into the first movements of modern humans across Eurasia. They have this connection, but it's really weird because they obviously weren't able to cross the giant Pacific Ocean to get to the Americas. Right. There's no evidence that suggests that could occur. And so they believe that potentially there was some ancestry that was related to them that was in mainland East Asia that contributed to them and that was carried over across the Bering Strait as well. And it's something that we don't have an individual for. Right. And so when we saw that Tangerine individual showed that same connection, that was sort of like a smoking gun of like, oh, there's definitely things in mainland East Asia that sort of shares these very, very early ancestry-like things. That's still just a vague hint. So I think we're still looking in East Asia to find something else that, you know, really, really clearly shows this connection between now Beijing area and then Papua New Guinea and the Americas. But then the fact that we have something in mainland Asia was sort of a big find for us.
So, yeah. So then what is, you know, your study and then, you know, finding Tenyuan, what is it filling in about our understanding of ancient East Asia?
Pre-Neolithic, there was all these different types of very, very diverse Asian ancestries. All of them are no longer found on their own today. They sort of maybe pop up, you know, in a few places in admixed form, but they're mostly not represented. And then you have this wave of some other ancestry that is now everywhere across present day East Asia. Farming definitely played a role. I think we see that over here, but then it seems a bit more complex than that because there are non-farming groups that are in the South that are more closely related to those farming groups and not to those Paleolithic hunter-gatherers like Tangerine. This is all speculation over here, but I think that sort of suggests that there's just a lot more population movement than people are normally typically thinking of with hunter-gatherers in mainland East Asia. But to like get at that genetically, we have to find a lot more samples and be able to get ancient DNA out of them.
I'm Alexa Lim, and this is Science Friday from WNYC Studios. There's like a lot of different ways to like study history, even ancient history. Why the way you do it? Why is that interesting to you?
My interest in this dates back to high school, where I really became interested in archaeology because I was interested in all the different ways, sort of how we can study humans. It's like a giant mystery where you can ask these questions about how they live. What were they eating? You know, what were they throwing away? What were they sort of keeping and burying with them, you know, that were things of value, and then sort of get at their motivations for why they were doing certain things. And I love that when I visited Jamestown when I was in ninth grade, and there was an archaeologist trying to tell us about that. And I was like, this is really neat that you can tell these things not by looking at written text. So I think that was sort of the first seed of being interested in human history. How did I end up on a computer coding, trying to compare genetic patterns?
Right.
And then so in college, I was trying to better understand the genetic aspects of this. And then what I was discovering is that people were better able to sequence humans, sequence anything. Mm-hmm. And then so you could start getting massive amounts of DNA from many, many different populations. It's becoming a big data question. I was interested in how is it that I can look and analyze big data that's coming from DNA and assess individuals from across different regions across the world to address what I think is the most interesting questions about human prehistory, you know, of like how their biological movements connect to what's observed culturally in their pottery and their tools and how that's shifted over time.
You've studied another population in Asia. I'm talking about pandas. You looked at the genome of a 22,000-year-old panda.
Yeah. So when you learn how to do the methodology, humans really aren't that different from, you know, all the other organisms out there. But this individual, the specimen, was from Guangxi, which is like one of the most southern provinces of China. And it's not an area where you find pandas today. So 22,000 years ago, when this panda was alive, there was obviously the pandas that would lead to the present day pandas that we don't have genetic samples for. But then there was also much, much different looking pandas genetically. And then so there was a high amount of genetic diversity that was present in pandas in the past. I don't know what their fur color would have looked like, but the reason that we were even looking at this specimen is because its skeletal morphology, so all we had was its skull, was very similar to pandas. So I don't think that if we, you know, were to walk in and see this Suzuko individual in a zoo, we would say like, oh, hey, this is a panda. But people who study pandas and who know what are the important sort of features about them, you know, looked at the skull and they were like, okay, this is definitely a panda that we had in the past.
Like you said, you can apply it to anything. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's cool to be able to talk about my research over here, especially since I think a lot of people don't know very much about Northern and Southern East Asia.
Melinda Yang is a professor of biology at the University of Richmond in Virginia. This is Science Friday. I'm Alexa Lim.
And that's about all the time we have for this week. If you missed any part of the program or you would like to hear it again, subscribe to our podcasts or ask your smart speaker to play Science Friday. Every day now is Science Friday. Oh, and one more thing. Earlier this week was World Bee Day. If you missed out on the celebration, we have a lesson about the bots and the bees for you. Our new video looks at RoboBee. Two Harvard engineers have gotten a step closer to creating a fleet of the winged miniature RoboBees. You can watch the video at sciencefriday.com/RoboBee. And you can say hi to us on social media, Facebook, Twitter, or email us. The address is, of course, scifry@sciencefriday.com. Send feedback. Tell us what you'd like us to cover, too. Have a great and safe weekend. I'm Ira Flatow.